When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Changes. It is Annie McManus here. My guest on Changes today is a triple threat. Rosie Jones is not just disabled, not just gay, but also a woman. Born in Bridlington in Yorkshire in 1990, Rosie Jones is a stand-up comedian, a comedy writer, a children's author, and an actor. Maybe you've seen her on programmes like 8 out of 10 Cats, Would I Lie to You, The Last Leg. Maybe you've seen her live at the Apollo or have booked tickets to see her on her Triple Threat tour this year. Maybe you know a young person who's reading her books about the adventures of Edie Eckhart, a young 11-year-old girl with cerebral palsy. Or maybe you, like me, have laughed and cried whilst watching her now BAFTA-nominated Channel 4 travel show Trip Hazard, My Great British Adventure. If you haven't come across Rosie Jones yet, then frankly, I am jealous, because encountering her on stage or on screen is a total joy. Rosie Jones, welcome to Changes.
Oh my God, Annie, that was a great intro ever. Thank you, and I am so happy to be here, because I'm such a fan of Changes, but more than that, Annie, I'm a fan of you.
Stop it, Rosie! I can't handle it! I am also a huge fan of you, and honestly, it's been so fun doing the research for this. Obviously, I've seen you on telly, but the first time I kind of put you and your name to box was my niece, who's also called Annie, who also has cerebral palsy, was reading your Edie Eckhart book. And I was like, what's that book? Because I always want to know what people are reading. She said, oh, it's this. And then I saw your name and then I was like, I know that name. And then it kind of all came together in my head. So it's been lovely kind of getting to know you and getting to see how you are affecting the lives of people around me as well. So tell me how you use your cerebral palsy and your speech as a tool in your stand-up comedy. I had initially the word weaponizing, but that sounds really aggressive.
Oh, Annie, we will use the word weaponizing because anything aggressive and forceful, I am there.
Love it.
But yeah, I love it. So we'll get into this probably later, but I've had cerebral palsy all my life, which means as far as I can remember, I've been aware that I'm different, but more than that, people are awkward around me. I saw one of my oldest friends yesterday and she said, my first memory of you is 4 years old coming into the class, starting school, and everyone had to sit down, and I stood at the front and I said, hello, I'm Rosie. I have a disability called cerebral palsy, which means I talk slowly, but apart from that, I'm just like you now. A, that's amazing. But B, as an adult, I'm a little bit like, ooh, why did you put it on a 4-year-old to explain herself? And that has carried through all my life. I feel like it's my responsibility to explain myself to people, which is on one side annoying, but on the other side amazing, because from a very young age I realised that I could break down barriers with humour. So even at 4 years old, I could go, "Hello, I'm Rosie, I wobble, but I'm not drunk." And that will make the other kids laugh. So when I started stand-up, I already knew I had that comedy edge, because I'd used it every time I entered any new space. But to do stand-up as a job, that was inconceivable growing up, because I would watch usually male, able-bodied, fast-talking stand-ups, and that is not me at all. So I thought, I can't do it as a job, because everyone will get to the punchline before I do. And then I thought, wait a minute, they will think they will get to the punchline, but if I write it in a way that always ends in a curveball, no one will know what I'm about to say. So the first joke I ever wrote was, as you can tell from my voice, I am a suffer from being northern. And I look back now and I'm like, that is such a cheap joke, and I feel like I'm better than that now. But it did the job. Everyone thought I was just explaining my disability before I started. But now I hit them out the gate with a joke. So for me, it's all about the writing. But as a writer, I love that. And I love how I got to think about every single syllable, because if it's not important, I'll drop it, because I got so much less time the non-disabled comedians.
Yeah, so you'll go on and you'll have like a 10-minute slot. And you'll have to, maximise every word that you can say. There's something so deep about that joke, though, Rosie. Like, the, as you can see, I suffer from being Northern. Because what it does is it kind of democratises the room in that you realise that everyone has their thing. And also, I wonder, like, just that kind of liberation of walking into a room and having to lay your cards on the table. Like, if anyone's listening now, if you were that person who had to walk into a room and explain yourself in one sentence, you know, which you do so well and you're so practiced at, there must be something quite liberating in that. Before anyone can judge you or make any assumptions, you can go, no, this is who I am. You've got the control there. In a way.
And I've recently started therapy, which I think is incredible and life-changing, and maybe she says it to everyone, but my therapist said, you know yourself so well, and I think it's because I have to, physically and mentally. So physically, I need to know exactly what I can and can't do. But also, when you're entering spaces where you got to reassure people that you are intelligent, that there's nothing wrong with you, that you deserve to be there, you need to have the confidence in yourself. Like, I think if I went into my Yorkshire school in the 90s at 4 years old and gone, hello, yeah. The sad truth is, I'd have no friends. I'd be the weirdo. I can't afford to be shy. I've got to go in there going, hello, I'm Rosie. I've got cerebral palsy. I love Lego. Shall we play Lego? Because at that age, children are so accepting. They just went, okay, you talk a bit weird, but I love Lego as well. So it's my friend who I saw yesterday said, at 5 years old, I never comprehended that you were disabled or different. You were Rosie. And I've kept that with me all my life. I think people might initially see my cerebral palsy, but literally 20 seconds in my company, hopefully you go, oh, that's Rosie, she's loud, funny, lovely, but let's be honest, a massive prick.
I don't think you're a massive prick. Only you.
Andy, you don't know me yet.
Okay, so let's go back to little Rosie Jones, 4 years old, entering the class. And I'm thinking of the parents who would have left you off to school that day, nervously, as any parent would leave their kid going to school. Who were your parents? What were they like? And I guess what kind of effect did they have on you growing up?
My parents are just a pair of legends.
Are they?
Yeah, Rob and Andrea Jones. I mean, we have a disagreement with this because my opinion is that of they are the best people in the world. And I got cerebral palsy because at birth I didn't breathe for 17 minutes. I nearly died. And my mum and dad were 26. And the nurses quite practically said to them, "We don't know. We don't know the extent of Rosie's disability. We don't know if she'll have intellectual disabilities." They didn't know whether I could walk, talk, anything. And all newborn babies look the same, so pretty much my mum and dad had to wait to see the extent of my disability. And then as I grew up, it became evident that even though I talked slowly and I didn't walk till I was 5, there was nothing wrong with my intelligence. So they just supported me, and I was the first disabled person to go to my local primary school, and then secondary school, and then I said, right, I'm going to uni, studied English, then I moved down to London after, and every step of the way, they never made me feel less able or incapable. So that's my version, but their version is, Rosie, we did nothing. You were an unstoppable force. We just said yes, and on the very few occasions we said no, you said, well, I'm doing it anyway. So I just think it's maybe we're both right. It's a great combination between loving and supportive parents and just a little stubborn bugger who never took no for an answer.
Yeah, I guess like they can say that they've done nothing, but the act of saying yes most of the time, that's the key. That's the magic. That's the enabling you to do what you feel like you should be able to do. Right, Rosie, let's talk about your first change. So your biggest change in childhood. Tell me about that, please.
Well, we touched on it.
Yeah.
And I'd say the biggest was going to a mainstream school. Because before that, I went to a all disabled school. And this sounds awful, and I am telling this story through the prism of a 4-year-old child. Sure. But I looked around at all the other children, and they had physical disabilities and intellectual disabilities. And I thought, why am I here? I can't explain it, but I innately knew that this wasn't a place I needed to be. So I went home and I said to my mum, I don't want to go there now. I want to go to big school. I couldn't walk at the time. And I said, if you let me go to big school, I promise I'll walk. And I taught myself, this is how driven and stubborn I am. I was like, well, I'm with all the people who can't walk. If I can just do a little two-leg action, I can get out of here. And I did. And that was life-changing for me, because I don't want to get too political, but I will. I think I'm the perfect age. I think if I were 10 years older, they wouldn't have let me go to a mainstream school.
Right.
I'd be in the disabled school till I was 18. And they simply didn't have the tools and the resources to educate someone who was a bit clever. But I went to school for the majority of New Labour. And at the time, I was given a teaching assistant one-to-one, and I got so much money from the government, and it was because of that care that I was able to succeed and be happy and safe in a mainstream school. And I loved my TA, and she's incredible. And I met up with her recently, and she still is in teaching. She loves her job. But unfortunately, now she's got to look at the 4, 5, 6 children with extra need. So that money and that care that I received has gone away. So I fear that if I went to school now, I wouldn't be able to grow and be looked after in the way I did in the 90s.
Yes. And the Disability Discrimination Act came in 95, yeah. Right, which is basically yeah. the first ever UK legislation protecting disabled people against various forms of discrimination. How did that change your life? Can you remember anything being different?
Oh, I mean, because of that act,
yeah.
that's why I went to remain.
You're allowed into the school?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then moving forward from that, just applying for jobs, being right. in spaces with toilets for me, being able to get onto buses.
Yeah.
I was only 5 years old at the time, so I do not think 5-year-old Rosie was super political, but I need to acknowledge that every part of my life I've been affected.
Yeah.
Because of the Disability Discrimination Act. So, as I say, I just think I was born in that sweet spot
yeah.
where disabled people were having rights, but they had the money, the resources and the care from the government that disabled people do not have right now.
Well, I want to talk about activism later, but just sticking to your story growing up, I know your books focus on a young girl with cerebral palsy who's going to secondary school. How was your experience of going to secondary school?
It's so funny. I got two opinions on my secondary school. One, how I felt there.
Right.
And two, looking back in hindsight. So when I went there, I loved it. And I always had friends and I was never bullied. I think because I was always the loud one, the talkative one. Like, I put a wall up to go, don't even try. And you know, if you say anything, I will make you look like a moron. It's like one time, a little scrow of a boy said, get some fucking proper legs. And I turned around and I went, oh, okay, what, where from? Like, is there a fucking proper leg shop? Can you buy him in bulk? Like, what do you mean by that? Because my legs look fucking proper, and just how and met that aggression with, okay, let's really deep dive into your fucking stupid comment.
Yeah.
And it made him feel tiny because I was like, you know what, I might keep my fucking improper legs because I like the shape. So, yeah, at the time, I loved it. It was so fun and not to toot my own drum or bang my own horn. I was always clever, so I always got by. I was always liked by teachers and kids. So I think I let Flora at 18 go and great. I'm not scared, but I'm glad I'm out now. So that's how it was in the present. In hindsight, a bit like a lot of my childhood, I felt like I survived secondary school, and I was hardworking, I was popular, but because I knew if I let my guard down for a second, I would have got eaten alive. And then again, in hindsight, I think a lot of my teenage years were taken up by having gay thoughts and fancying girls and watching Terry Hatcher playing Lois Lane and thinking, I really like her and I don't know why. I like Bridlington. It will always be my hometown, but it is small-minded. It is backwards. A bit like everywhere in the 90s, the word lesbian and gay were thrown around like an insult. So I spent a lot of my childhood thinking, I'm not a lesbian because that's a bad thing. And it was only at 21 when I moved to London and my friends became queer and diverse and non-white and other disabled people, it made me go, oh, right, I'm not alone, I can come out, I can be myself in such a way that I don't ever think I've fully embraced who I am in the 18 years in Bridlington.
You know, you're in therapy now. Do you feel like you're still fully embracing who you are as a woman in her 30s?
Yeah, that's a big question. Yeah, I embrace who I am. I embrace being a comedian with a platform. I embrace my sexuality. I am a proud gay woman. Side note, I describe myself as gay because that word lesbian for me still has negative connotations. So yeah, Rosie as a singular person, I embrace it and proud of myself. But if I'm honest, I'm single and I've been dating and I am so happy being single, but I can't imagine getting married. I can't imagine having children, even though I think I want children. I can't imagine being in a happy, healthy relationship with somebody. And that is because I have grown up in a world where I don't see disabled people depicted on TV in happy, healthy relationships. And as I say, I date a lot and I enjoy having fun, but I think when it gets a little bit serious, there's a voice in my head going, you're disabled, you don't deserve this, you're a burden on her, you're a burden on society. And I never feel that when I'm a singular person. It is when I try to include somebody else in the situation who are the women I normally date just happen to be non-disabled. And I think that is a factor. It's the moment where they see what it's like to be disabled every day by society makes me go into pushing away mode. Maybe because I know I can cope with it on my own. But if I care about someone, I don't want them to see what I see.
You got to find another Rosie. You've got to find someone with the kind of same type of tenacity as you. Or I think the therapy will hopefully like help you realize that you're an asset to anyone who goes out with you. You know, it's that, isn't it? It's that kind of like realizing that they are lucky to have you and what you bring to the relationship, you know?
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Listen, can we talk about your adult change? You cite the moment at 27 when you started comedy. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so before that, I've been living in London for 6 years. I had been working in TV. I'd really enjoyed it. And I'd had a lot of friends saying to me, "Go on, try comedy." And I'd always be like, no one sounds like me. You don't really get disabled comedians, no. And then that changed, and I don't know where it happened. It was just a feeling that if I don't try this now, I never will. And I'd never want to get to the end of my life regretting anything. And I think before we briefly chatted about my birth and how I didn't breathe for 70 minutes, I nearly died. And I feel like I've always been super aware that there is a scenario in which I'm not alive. So I've always been quite fearless because of that. I'm very aware that we only live once. So I was like, worst case scenario, I'll do a stand-up show, I'll die, I'll get booed up stage, and that's it. And I would have tried it, but that didn't happen. Like, my first stand-up gig was in a shitty little bar in Dalston to 10 people. And in hindsight, it was grim, but the whole feel of it, holding the microphone, being on stage, making people laugh, was all I needed to go, yeah, I like it. And I think when I worked in TV, when I worked on panel shows, I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make TV and the world in general more accepting and welcoming for disabled people. And I think I was making a difference in my own little groups. I was making sure no one non-disabled was shitting in the disabled toilet. But it was when I started stand-up that I thought, wow, I can really make a difference. And what I've been doing in my own little way, in work, in pubs, in my friendship groups of talking to people, explaining my disability, showing people that even though I talk slowly, I'm intelligent and funny and blah, blah, blah. Everything that I had spent 27 years doing, I could now do on a larger scale. And now with the books, with the touring, with meeting people, like, I nearly cried when you said Annie had cerebral palsy and she reads my books, because that is why I do what I do, so that another little girl or boy in a little northern town is feeling a bit alone and confused to why they're disabled and all their mates aren't. They can turn on the telly or read a book and just go, I'm not alone. And it's stories like Annie that make me go, yeah, I'm tired. Yeah, I haven't had a full day off in about 2 years, but I'm making a difference.
Oh, God, Rosie, you're going to have me in bits. Jesus, can't handle it. You are, though. You so are. You're changing the world. You're changing the world just by doing your job, being up there every day. And it's so interesting how you talk about, like, you knew you were funny because you'd done it all your life. But also it's important for anyone listening to know that you worked as a gag writer before you were a stand-up. So you were a professional funny person. Your battle for you wasn't whether you were good at being a stand-up comedian. It was whether you could do it for you, right? And whether people would accept you as a stand-up comedian, right?
Yeah, and I mean, what is interesting is on top of all of that, I'm a woman. Yeah. And I think you find that a lot of female stand-ups have come into the business a different way, because this is a sweeping statement, but on the whole, men are more arrogant enough to go, I'm funny, I'm gonna start stand up dry. No one's told me that I'm funny, but I am. Whereas my way into it, and of course, being disabled is a part of it, but my way was, am I funny? I need to check, I need to get the experience, I need to hone my skills, I need to do a comedy writing course, I need to write for other comedians to hone my craft. And it was only then, when I'd had 6 years writing for other people, that I could go, right, I think I got the knowledge and the tools and the extra babies to go at it myself.
Can I ask about the kind of intersection between you as Rosie Jones, comedian, getting on with your life, to being Rosie Jones, activist, person who represents a huge swathe of people in our country that aren't represented on stage and on screen? How do you reconcile those two things? I can imagine, and I don't know, but I can imagine there might be a day where you're just like, I don't feel like being an activist today. I just want to eat my cornflakes and get on with my day, you know? I don't feel like having to speak for so many people.
Yeah, the truth is, it changes every day. Like, I need to remember that I am first and foremost a comedian. My top line job description is make people laugh. That's it. If I do that, job done. But I need to be aware that I am female, I am gay, I am disabled, and I have the platform and I have the opportunity to talk on behalf of those communities. And I can hopefully change people's minds and do a little bit of good in the world. And I think for me, a big shift was the pandemic, because that was a interesting combination between my career somehow took off during lockdown, and I feel like because of the government, because of the pandemic, disabled people were a community that weren't being talked about as openly. And fundamentally, disabled people were dying because they didn't have the care or resources that they needed. I thought it was extremely damaging when, at the beginning of the pandemic, people were saying, don't worry, it only kills people with pre-existing health conditions. Essentially, that is people with disabilities. And I definitely felt like a second class citizen during that time. And that is when I got the opportunity to go on Question Time. And I was able to look Matt Hancock, who was Health Secretary at the time, I could look at him in the eye and say, what are you doing for disabled people? At that time, we had 10 years of a Tory government where year after year they had stripped the disability benefits down and down and down. And it was the 25-year anniversary of the Disability Discrimination Act, and I said the act was brought in a quarter of a century ago. I don't think we've nearly made enough progress. We need to do more. And about a minute went all over Hancock's fucking head. But by me saying that, I really felt like I made a difference. And I spoke for us, a group of people who don't often get the spaces to talk. Yeah. So I will continue to campaign and fight and talk for us. But at the same time, there's a few disabled people who say you need to do more. I recently got a lot of abuse online because not my own talk shows, but I sometimes perform other people's gigs in places that are inaccessible. And I get people going, why is she doing that? And the unfortunate truth is 90% of comedy venues are downstairs or upstairs, and if I took a stand and I never performed in those clubs, A, I'd never have work, and B, I would be simply replaced. Yeah. By a non-disabled comedian, and I make sure that a lot of my venues are accessible, but I also don't want to deprive non-disabled crowds. Yeah. Of seeing me, because you never know what difference I can make to non-disabled people. So, yeah, to summarise, I love making a difference, and I think it is so important to speak out and be proud of who I am. But my job title is comedian, so if I want to go on stage and for one evening not talk about any activism and just talk about how great my tits are, let me do that.
Rosie, okay. The last change question is, what change you'd still like to make or see? Now, this can be about you and your life and your situation, or it could be about the world around you.
I'm going to make it about me.
Good woman.
I want to care less about what other people think of me. I am naturally an upbeat, happy, honest person, but I'm not like that 24/7, and I want to get to a space where if I'm tired, if I'm fucked off, and I go into a cafe and I get recognised, I am able to go, "Hello, I don't want photos today," because I think I'm at the point now where I give everyone everything. And as soon as I leave my house, my guard is up and I am, "Hello, I'm Rudy, always happy, never sad. Love being disabled, I love it, I love being disabled. And the truth is, I don't. Sometimes if it's 4 a.m. and an Uber driver won't pick me up because I think I'm drunk, I'm fucked off. I don't want to plead with a driver. I'm not drunk. Honestly, I'm disabled. I should be allowed to just be myself and not be the shiny, happy, rosy that I had to be for other people."
Do you feel like your comedy is changing? As you change, your perception of yourself changes as you're growing, as you're doing therapy, as you're doing the work, as they call it. Wonder what will happen with your comedy. Like, will you go darker?
I think that's what's so exciting about comedy, because we all change. I will change. At the moment, I'm a woman in her early 30s. I plan on being a performer until I die. So I'm excited to see that change. And I think I will become more unapologetic. I will become, "Right, this is me. If you're not into it, fuck off. You look nervous. Get gone." And I am not apologising again for who I am.
Rosie Jones, you're a fucking legend.
This has just been the best conversation.
I mean, it's the nicest way to spend a morning you could wish for.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Rosie Jones, ladies and gents, what an absolute legend. So warm, so smart, so funny. Of course, she would be being a stand-up comedian, but such a unique take on comedy and on the world. And I think we can all agree the world is a much better place having Rosie Jones in it. There's moments when you watch her on stage where just the second after she drops a punchline, her entire face transforms from being, you know, quite serious to being the embodiment of joy. I can't describe it, but I've never encountered anyone with a smile like Rosie Jones. It's unbelievable. Go and look at it and you cannot not feel joyous watching it. Now, to consume Rosie Jones and all of her work. So she's on tour. It's called the Triple Threat Tour. I think you can still get tickets to that now. She has her amazing Edie Eckhart books. If you know of any young people who might be interested in reading about the adventures of Edie, then go and get them. They'll be lovely presents for people. And also, whatever you do, go and check out Trip Hazard, My Great British Adventure on 4OD. You can still watch them on there. They're such lovely, lovely programs. Rosie brings a celebrity with her to a different part of the UK on every episode. So you kind of learn about the UK. You also have amazing rapport between Rosie and the celebrity. And Rosie kind of pushes herself to the limits of her disability in every app. And it's, yeah, just a hugely kind of thrilling and interesting watch. She's just so watchable. Yeah, let's all just be Rosie Jones's biggest fans from now on. I am. And that is it for this week, folks. Thank you so much for listening. Please do share this episode to anyone who you think will appreciate it. And subscribe to Changes as well. That's always so, so cool if you could do that. We're very grateful. It means you'll get the episodes that come every Monday morning delivered straight to you. We'll be back next week with another episode of Changes. Until then, huge love. This episode was produced by Louise Mason through DIN Productions. See ya.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.